This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Viglin.
It's Marketplace Tech Report from APM, American Public Media. I'm John Moe.
Welcome to Marketplace's weekly Staff Picks Remarket podcast. This is the installment for Friday, April 6th. I'm Nancy Fergali, and I work here. And today they turn the mic over to me and my sensibilities. So just in case you're wondering, go Red Sox. I digress. The podcast you're about to hear is basically things that I thought were interesting, thought-provoking, original, inventive, water cooler-like moments across our shows this week. So if I have to come up with a theme, it's probably love, our relationship to products, people, and things that we have to do in our daily lives. So I'm going to start with a book. Now, let me just give you an image. If you come into Marketplace, you will see stacks and stacks and stacks and stacks of books. We get a lot of them. And our job is to figure out what books are going to be relevant, interesting, what books will make our audience think, what books will make our audience wonder, wow, why did they pick that book? So I'm going to start today with a book that was done on our Marketplace Tech Report. The show is hosted by John Moe, and I'll let John take it away.
If you need the floor vacuum, you could use a vacuum cleaner robot. What if you want to understand evolution? John Long says, same deal. He's the author of Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. Long's a professor at Vassar College, where he builds evolving robots.
An evolving robot is a special kind of robot that we designed, first of all, to be like an animal, and second of all, to have the ability to make children.
What do you mean, children?
We set up a population of robots that are designed to mimic critters that have behavior, and we compete them in the game of life. I mean, it's kind of like the Hunger Games is what we do in our laboratory. And then we rank them, and the winners get to reproduce. And the reproduction that I'm talking about is it happens in software, so it's nothing untoward in terms of watching things happen in the laboratory. But we have genetics for our robots. Different characters that they have are coded mathematically, just like genes. And then we recombine those genetics, we mutate them, we put them in a what we call a mating bucket, which is just a fancy name for fiddling around on the computer. And then we produce the instructions for making the next generation of those robots.
And thank you for introducing the term mating bucket to our audiences.
Yeah, yeah.
But what kind of competitions do they engage in?
We're really interested in what are the selection pressures that may have driven evolution 500 million years ago in the first vertebrates, right? You and I are vertebrates, and it's this group of animals that have backbones. How might those backbones have arisen? And so we compete these fish-like robots in experiences that we think they may have been having 500 million years ago, and it's eating and not being eaten. So that's the competition.
If you want to learn about animals, why don't you just study animals?
Because we like toys.
Sure.
No. We do study animals, in fact, and we do as much as we can with the animals, but there's only so many things you can do because animals are so complex. You pick what you want to model. So our fish-like robots, for example, we don't worry about them actually taking food in. We build a brain like the brain in a fish. We give them eyes. We give them this thing called a lateral line, which is a pressure wave detector on the side of a fish. And then we give them a tail that beats like a fish. But that's it. Then when your system does something in front of you, when you're watching the Hunger Games, as it were, then you can understand why it's changed because the system is simple enough to tease apart.
So here with me in the studio is John Moe, the host of the Marketplace Tech Report, and he did the interview. And why this book? You probably get hundreds and hundreds of books on technology. So why did you pick this one?
Yeah, we get a lot of books. Well, it's funny. The book came in and Larissa Anderson, my producer, got it first. And she said, okay, the name of the book is Darwin's Devices, What Evolving Robots Can Teach Us About the History of Life and the Future of Technology. And I just said, yes. Yes, we're doing that. And she said, oh, I had you at robots, did I? I said, no, you had me at Darwin's. The idea of robots that evolve and how they connect with Darwin and what Darwin discussed was really interesting to me. I mean, in real life, my my son finished a report for school not long ago on sort of a biography of Charles Darwin. So it was much discussed in our house. But beyond that, we do a fair number of robot stories on our show because they're always interesting and often cute and sort of funny and weird and somewhat disturbing. So it makes for good stories. And in this case, it wasn't about putting them on the battlefield. So often, a lot of robot research is funded by DARPA, which is an agency of the Department of Defense. And so you hear about these really amazing robots, and then you get to the part of, okay, well, what are you going to do with this little throwable spy robot? Oh, it'll be used on the battlefield, or it'll be used to provide something for soldiers on the battlefield. It'll be used, for some unexplained purpose, but it's funded by the Department of Defense. And, you know, that's all fine, I guess. But what we loved about this story and what we loved about John Long's take on it was that, no, he's building robots to help understand life and where life evolved from and where life is evolving into. And then on top of that, he happened to be a really funny guy.
Well, I wanted to follow up on what you just said in terms of life. This was probably a 3-minute interview. And obviously, if we wanted to talk about life, it would be much longer. One of the images that really struck me was this idea of the game of life. Do you remember playing that game when you were a kid?
Sure.
Do you remember the song?
You can learn about life when you play the game of life.
Yeah, you can be a winner at the game of life. I'm sure people are now saying, oh my gosh, I need to tune this out. But I wanted to ask you about how you go about shaping an interview that's so short, because I thought this interview had some really nice images that are very familiar to people, like the game of life. I'm sure you probably talked to him for more than 3 minutes. So how do you go about shaping it so that you get a topic like robots, which can be complicated, and shaping it so that people kind of understand it in terms of their own everyday life?
Well, yeah, I mean, the guest always helps in that regard, too. And this guy was really good at explaining what it was. I mean, he used a Hunger Games analogy to talk about these robots that he builds, and then he has them compete against each other. And then he sees which one does the best, and then that's the one that gets to reproduce. And so, you know, like, that idea, he was able to explain that pretty thoroughly and pretty quickly. Then you kind of, anytime you talk about anything reproducing, you know, you're going to get a radio audience's attention, especially when it's a robot. So that, you know, that led to the natural second question of, wait, what do you mean reproduce?
What do you mean by mating bucket, which I thought was such a nice phrase, especially in this day and age of online dating. I thought, gosh, if robots had to create an online dating site, they probably would come up with the term mating bucket. Can you talk a little bit about mating bucket?
I actually saw Mating Bucket open for Mudhoney and Nirvana in Seattle in 1992, and they were really good. That's when they had their first bass player. I'm always a little conscious of how, or a lot conscious of how a radio audience is going to hear a story. And so, you know, you listen, and then you kind of just take the reaction that is the normal human reaction when somebody says mating bucket, like, okay, let's draw a little bit of attention to that phrase. So he used that, and then I called it out and just as an aside said, well, thank you for introducing the term mating bucket.
That's John Moe from the Marketplace Tech Report. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Nancy.
Mating bucket. Your challenge for the week is to figure out a way to use that term in a conversation. Now to a story about a different type of love or a different type of relationship. Let's say it's a relationship on the verge of breaking up. The story that you're about to hear is about Sony and its consumers. And the reason why this story struck me is it used to be that if you were talking about music, you were talking about Sony. You were talking about the Walkman. Now, if you want to have a conversation about music, you're probably talking about iTunes, Apple, the iPod, Pandora, Spotify. Our reporter Scott Tong recently traveled to Japan, and I thought this was a great story because Scott really gets into the heart of what Sony is facing with its consumers.
In Tokyo's electronics market, Akihabara, shoppers talk about Sony like it's an aging superhero. Yusuke Akimoto and Koji Hodo land the first punches.
I don't really use a Sony product recently. My phone is like Galaxy, it's from Samsung.
The other companies are able to like produce TVs, smartphone devices at the same price or even better quality.
Ouch! From another direction, Cassie Harada at the coffee shop.
Very, very overpriced. Okay. I always say you get the least bang for your buck out of Sony products.
Kapow. Sony's been losing money 4 years straight. It's one-fifth the size it used to be. A long decline for a corporate crusader with a proud history. An exhibit at the Sony Company Museum has engineer Nobutoshi Kihara showing a tape recorder from 1949.
Testo, testo.
He talks into the mic and plays it back.
Testo, testo. Why?
A corporate video picks up the history from there. Okay, it is from the 70s. There's Sony's transistor radio, the world's first CD player, mini TV. Ulrika Shada teaches Japanese business at the University of California, San Diego. She sees a core brilliance at Sony.
The Walkman, when they came up with that idea, we had no idea that we wanted to listen to music while we were on the run. But we embraced it.
Sony helped turn Japan into a speeding post-war bullet. In 1950, the average Japanese made one-fifth his American peer. By the late 80s, poof, the gap vanished. But then, Shada says, engineers took over the company, started ignoring consumers. Exhibit A, Sony's Betamax versus Panasonic's VHS.
Panasonic, even though it had a lesser technology, they made a tape that would go for 3 hours so we could tape a football game, whereas Sony's Betamax would only run for 1 hour. It was less useful for the consumer.
Another challenge is something you see on the subway here. The women carry designer handbags, the men have expensive phones. Japan's rich. So, like America, the labor costs are high, which makes Sony's products expensive, compared to, say, Samsung from Korea. Samsung blew past Sony in TV sales in 2005. Sony came late to smartphones, tablets, flat screens. Even in portable audio, the maker of the analog Walkman lost the digital market. Jeff Kingston at Temple University in Tokyo says Sony did develop two song players before the iPod.
They had one product that was created by the Walkman unit, another created by the VAIO computer unit, and they couldn't decide which one to promote, and both of them never got traction.
These days, he says, the company is circling the drain.
They're not really part of the conversation. They are like a shy, retiring company, the dowdy aunt.
Bam, that one hurt. Sony didn't comment for tape. But in Tokyo, executives blame outside factors. Earthquake, tsunami, floods. Without all those, the just-departed CEO Howard Stringer says Sony would be in the black. Stringer promoted the new Men in Black 3 film at the recent Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas. There, the man who just replaced Stringer, Kaz Hirai, pledged allegiance to the consumer.
I've created a group to explore the user experience. It's the combination of devices, services, and content that makes it easy and fun for you to play, watch, listen, and share.
Sony's task, says Ulrika Shada at UC San Diego, is not to make incrementally nicer devices. It needs a disruptor, a game changer. Pick your cliche. The opportunity's there.
The next big battle is going to be about our living rooms, or our houses, actually. One day we will have intelligent refrigerators and washer dryers, and so when we go to the store, we can look at our cell phone and it will tell us whether we need milk.
Back in Tokyo, shoppers wonder if Sony can fit into that old superhero suit again. The new boss is open to shedding workers and factories and products. But a superhero is not all about losing weight. It's about adding a weapon. In Tokyo, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
We have an on-air opinion segment, and these pieces reflect a lot of different topics, viewpoints, opinions. And one of the pieces that aired this week got a lot of traffic. And what I mean by traffic is lots of comments, lots of feedback. So let's first listen to the piece.
I love taxes. When I pay my taxes, I'm telling my community I value you. I'm talking about the guy who works for the Department of Transportation who helped me get to and from school on thousands of job interviews. I'm talking about my teachers, Miss Smith, who is my high school English teacher and saw something in me, Miss Marshall, the junior high journalism instructor who saw I was abused and got me into foster care. A long, achy road, but one that perhaps saved my life. the nurses who tended to me when I was exposed to tuberculosis as a young child, the military that helped so many members of my family escape poverty and discover a nation they believed in so much they'd risk their lives for it, the firefighters who do the unthinkable, who run into burning buildings for perfect strangers, firefighters who often had to come out to emergency cold weather shelters where I worked in the middle of the night to tend to a homeless person who was scared they were losing their mind. Sometimes all they needed was some attention. I'll never forget one Christmas working in the shelter, a firefighter bent down in front of a homeless woman, smiling, and placed a Band-Aid on her unwounded elbow just to give her a secret joy. If we're saying, "I value you," when we pay our taxes, what are the people and corporations who don't pay all their taxes saying? Are they saying the opposite? Are they saying that all those people who do so much for us every day don't matter?
That was a commentary by Melissa Chadburn, and online it slugged "I Heart Taxes." I decided to bring in Steve Gregory. He's a editor here, and he edited the piece, and we got a lot of listener response from it. And we tend to get a lot of listener response from our commentaries. But I wanted to ask you, why did you pick this piece to put on air?
I picked this piece to put on air because the issue of taxes, can be polarizing. But the thing that I really liked about this piece was that I thought that it could resonate with everyone, who has an opinion on taxes, because Melissa Chadburn took the level to a very personal place. And one of the things that I try to look for in commissioning commentaries is, people who can, make the issue very personal. This commentary really grabbed the attention of many people because she was basically able to sort of go through her own life and pick points where taxpayer-funded services were very beneficial, if not formative for her. So that I think that was the main reason.
You talked about making something personal, and we're a show about the economy, so a lot of times it's trying to find that personal way to tell a complicated story. One of the things that she does in the piece from the get-go, her first line is, "I love taxes." And I think it probably got a lot of people who are listening in the car or listening at home to kind of stand up and say, "Wait, what did she say?" Because taxes, as you said, is very polarizing. When you got the first draft of the commentary, was that the first line?
It was the first line. The way it happened is I reached out to her after reading her a blog posting. This particular riff was sort of buried in kind of a long blog post that she updates regularly. I zeroed in on that line, "I love taxes," and thought that because of that, it would also make for good listening.
There's a difference, I think, sometimes when you read an opinion piece in a newspaper versus an opinion piece on radio. Our format is shorter, and you want people to be more direct, more conversational. How do you translate something that appears in print or online to something that people are going to hear on the radio?
What I try to do before, I send something back to a contributor is read the text or, read the written words with her voice in the back of my head. And if, that voice sounds a little too scripted or a little too printy, then, I'll try to make changes that sort of reflect more of a conversational sensibility. And in this case, I was lucky because she wrote most of it in a very informal conversational way.
And that's the end of our conversation. Thanks to Steve and John Moe for coming in and talking a little bit about these stories. And thanks for listening to the Remarket podcast for Friday, April 6th. I'm Nancy Fergali, and go Red Sox!